Our speaker for this morning's chapel service is Dr. Eddie Dwyer, acting chairman of the Department of Religion in Baylor University. Dr. Dwyer is a native of Oklahoma, a graduate of Oklahoma Baptist University, a graduate of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, and he holds the Ph.D. degree from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. It is a pleasure to welcome Dr. Dwyer to our campus, and especially to present him as the leader of this morning's chapel service.
Although it is the customary thing to say, I'm sure, I do feel compelled to express my gratitude for the wonderful, generous gesture extended by your president and others on the campus in inviting us to your campus. I have looked forward to coming with great anticipation in order to become better acquainted with the seminary, to see again some of my former professors, and to meet former students, and to become acquainted with some of you. I have appreciated very much the warm, hospitable spirit with which we have been welcomed to the campus. And not least of all, I have enjoyed thoroughly the beautiful profusion of color that has dotted the landscape on my flight over here. It's such a contrast to the almost colorless, level, and almost treeless land of Central Texas. About the only color we've had this fall was last week in San Antonio. We did have a colorful, eventful convention there. It is a real pleasure to be here today, and I have one verse of scripture to read. I'm sure it has been used many times here. In 1 Peter 4 and 10, as every man hath received the gift, even so minister the same one to another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. This is one of the several texts, classic texts, that suggests that the incomparable privilege, and may I say the terrible responsibility that rests upon Christians and especially ministers, is that of the stewardship of grace. There comes to us from French history a human story that says something to us. Three men had been imprisoned in a French dungeon. In the dungeon, several feet from the dark, damp floor, had been hewn out in the wall a ledge large enough for one man to sit on. Also, there had been hewn out crude steps leading up to the ledge. During one period, brief period of the day, the warm rays of the sun penetrated to the ledge. One day, a passerby, moved by compassion, dropped a leaflet, a printed message on Christian hope, into the dungeon. And it so happened that only one of the men could read. But they agreed that the one who could read would sit on the ledge on condition that he would translate the message to the other two. Now, while I do not liken the world to a dungeon, this does remind us that we are the most privileged people in the world, in that we have been permitted to to experience the sun rays of God's redeeming grace. But the responsibility, the condition that is ours, is that we translate it to the world. About a decade and a half ago, a leading Jewish rabbi of Dallas made a rather unusual observation. He said the conscience of Dallas today is George W. Truett. At least this was a way of saying that George W. Truett had a voice and was heard by the people of his day. Well, I think there have been many eras in church history when the church, in a real sense, has been the conscience of a part of the world. The church has spoken, it has had a voice, it has been heard by the world. I do not wish to seem pessimistic, but it is rather obvious that something is happening to the church. Her voice is not as strong as it was. Now, although the church has run a rather bloody gauntlet for 19 centuries, she continues to run the gauntlet, but she is wounded. She is not as strong as perhaps times in the past. One glimpse of church history, of course, reveals to us that there have always been many external blows against her, and we glory in her triumph. The first, I guess, serious blow was by the Jewish nation itself, because of a powerful nationalism, race prejudice, religious bigotry, intolerance, her power was focused against the church. And then she felt the blow of the non-Christian, Gentile world, unofficially and officially, under such leaders as Nero, of course, Domitian, Diocletian. One of the hardest external blows, of course, came in the 4th century, as all of us know, with the rise of the ecclesiastical power, the Roman hierarchy. It seems that it is human nature to organize, and at that time, human nature was conventional, at least was not restrained. The prophetic spirit was submerged. The expectancy of Christ's return was fading away. A wave of speculation endangered the life of the church. And consequently, the priestly authority was originated, at least for one reason, to stop it. Consequently, the state church. The early church, of course, was almost absorbed, but not quite. But the church has continued to run the gauntlet. She has felt the extreme blows of humanism, materialism, atheism, and of course today, communism. But I believe there are evidences that the most stifling blow to retard, to injure, is not an external blow, but an internal one. All who are involved in Christian education today and in quality church programs are keenly sensitive to a religious current of extremism, which in a sense is enjoying an unprecedented resurgence. It takes the form of legalism, literalism, and authoritarianism. The spirit of operation is that of coercion, doctrinal conformity, and religious boycott. At times, the leaders assume the role of conscious reformers who commonly are suspicious of all who would be progressive, even the progressive conservatives. Like all religious movements that experience a resurgence, this one has become conspicuous through the creation of tensions. The tensions, however, have been created by making issues out of secondary matters and often trivial matters. Those who are possessed with the spirit of this religious movement make much effort to defend the orthodoxy of historic Christianity. The problem is they do not always distinguish between historic Christianity and Christianity. Because the criteria for success is in quantitative results, the use of sensational, dramatic, and cheap gimmicks and bandwagon tactics are employed. It tends to create an image of the church in the eyes of the world, which causes the world to turn a deaf ear to the church. Because of the absence of a theological interpretation, there is often lacking a sound philosophy of life and education. Consequently, there are sometimes hurtful tensions between our Christian educational institutions and our churches. When our educators do not conform to dogmatic assertions that cannot be validated, the respective schools are often made to be scapegoats. But probably most tragic is the determination to maintain the status quo. I think one of my greatest shocks was the occasion of my visit to the church where I was converted, my visit about a year ago, where I was converted and surrendered to the ministry. It had been some 20 years since I was last there. When I left the church for a life in the ministry, the church was a rather active community church. A few good-hearted, well-meaning, dedicated people were in leadership. The leadership was not strong, but I remember two great pronounced concerns in the church. One of them was evangelism, and all efforts were directed in that direction. The other one was the concern for the defense of orthodoxy. I left with the impression that one of the greatest responsibilities in the world was the defense of orthodoxy as held by that church. Upon my return, 20 years later, the same people were in leadership. The same simple services were followed, the same emotions, the same level of immaturity was sustained. The church was fighting and struggling to maintain the status quo, although the community had changed with the rest of the world. I have been conscious of the fact that this is rather prevalent. One writer interprets this inner religious current to indicate that we are moving rapidly toward deism. in a little book, Honest to God, by A.T. Robinson, a book which has hit our campuses recently, the author sees a tendency among American Christians to relegate God to a transcendent state and insists that the trend toward deism is leading us to a religious revolution as great as the Copernican Revolution. Although I am far from being convinced that deism will triumph, I am sure that this is the trend for many. Now, although the church has run the gauntlet and has been the victim of many forces that have retarded and hurt, there is one encouraging factor, and that is that there is widespread awareness of her illness. And because of this general awareness, many solutions are being offered. Some are pointing out that the need is to project the gospel on a higher intellectual level, a level commensurate with the rising cultural level of our American society. Kenneth Scott Latterett, on a recent visit to Baylor University, observed that during the early period of American history, when the frontiers were being expanded, that Baptists made a great contribution by presenting Christianity in a simple, raw language to the uncultured pioneers. And then he continued, "Today our world has changed. Society is being filled with college graduates. And unless we project the gospel on an intellectual level equal to the rising cultural level, life will go out of our churches. The church will not be heard. The membership will be made up mainly of nominal Christians who join because it is the respectable thing to do." Another cry is for the restructuring of our organizational life. We are under heavy criticism because of centralizing authority, because of the complexity of our structure. Recently, an outstanding Presbyterian spokesman said that the Protestant churches have clung tenaciously to phases of our organization, although they are in many cases obsolete. As a result, the church, he says, tends to become an end in itself. He pointed out that while our churches have become involved in automated bookkeeping jobs due to the great transfer of membership, the churches are not being heard and are not reaching the non-Christian world. And of course, others are saying that our only hope is evangelism. Still others are proposing that there be sounded from our pulpits the quality of preaching that will create wholesome tensions in our world. The emphasis is on relevant preaching as our paramount need. Preaching that involves a theological interpretation as well as a sensitivity to the problems of man and a sense of urgency to relate the two. Others see as a solution to our problem the church becoming involved more and more in social action. We are constantly being reminded that there is a desperate need for interest in and action on the part of Christian leaders in regard to the acute and explosive social issues of the present time. John Bennett says that no degree of depth of theology and no degree of warmth of piety can compensate for failure in social sensitivity. There is a growing conviction that best wishes must be changed into good deeds, that fine-sounding pronouncements must be replaced by functioning progressive programs, that vague generalities must give way to specific proposals, that Christian approval of injustice must be withdrawn for favor of justice for all, and that non-Christian divisions, because of prejudice and hate, must go in favor of fellowship based upon Christian love. Now, to be sure, there is merit in all of these suggestions, and I'm sure that there is no one factor that is the answer. That changes in our complex organizational life are necessary, many would agree. That there is poverty of preaching, gospel preaching, in many of our pulpits, and that there is a vast need of more preaching with intellectual respect as well as spiritual warmth, no one of any degree of Christian maturity would deny. All of us would agree that it is imperative that our ministers have intellectual training equal to that of the leadership of any other vocation in the world, that the church be involved in social action. Few would raise a question. It is always proper that we rethink and restate our theological positions. While all of these matters are pertinent and should be taken seriously, it seems to me that there is something more vital than all of these, though it cannot be considered separately. I believe that those incisive souls who are emphasizing the primacy of worship are voicing one of the most basic needs, if not the supreme need. During a wartime broadcast, the Archbishop of Canterbury affirmed that the world can be saved only by worship. Of course, what he meant was that in worship, men are changed and motivated into redemptive service. He said, quote, "To worship is to quicken the conscience by the holiness of God, to feed the mind with the truth of God, to purge the imagination by the beauty of God, to open the heart to the love of God, and to devote the will to the purpose of God." Now, while his definition may not be all-inclusive, it seems to strike at vital points. I wonder if I might dare suggest this morning that the worship that is so essential is in a real sense a mystical experience. Mystical in the sense of a direct and intimate consciousness of the divine presence. Now, I hesitate to use the word because it has been made to apply to every type of esoteric and theosophic knowledge. Mysticism even means spurious knowledge in the scientific laboratory. Therefore, I hasten to say that I do not mean by it what the Greeks meant or what most of our contemporaries mean. It does not mean negation of personality or the transcending of self or the climbing of the intellectual ladder of reason and taking a leap. I do not mean what the love-sick mystics mean when they speak of trances or extreme ecstatic moments or audible voices, neither do I mean a supra-rational way of knowing, but Christian mysticism, Christian worship, is the natural involvement of all of the God-given native capacities of man in a vital relationship with God. It is the positive response of the total being to the initiative of God. I'm not talking about forms and methods, but this central, intimate, personal experience that tends to motivate us for all that is worthwhile. This kind of worship, in a real sense, is an end in itself. Instead of our attempting to approach God by coercing Him, inveigling Him to give us a reward or a desired blessing, it is more the spontaneous response of the soul in gratitude, adoration, reverential awe. It is an end in itself. Thomas Aquinas had this experience. He once had a dream, and in the dream, the divine asked him what reward he chose. His reply was, "The only reward I choose, O Lord, is Thee." The quality of worship, then, that is so essential, if we are to have a voice, is that which involves conscious response to a living, environing, indwelling Christ. There's much to be said about worship, but let me raise one final question briefly. Why is worship looked upon as so essential, so important? This worship that involves a desire for God and a sense of need, a willingness to permit Him to be where He is and what He is, without attempting to manipulate Him. Why is it so important? It is worship that involves a right attitude toward God, a right attitude toward our fellow man, a right attitude toward ourselves. It is worship that creates that warm, spiritual, contagious atmosphere that is conducive to discipleship, Christian maturity, the bond of Christian fellowship, and heroic Christian service. It is worship that challenges us to social action. Worship creates a consciousness of the responsibilities of kingdom citizenship. When men worship, in a genuine sense, in the church, the members are caught up in a group spirit. Frictions disappear. A high quality of fellowship is sustained. There is a natural inner compulsion to share in the whole redemptive enterprise. Bowman affirms that always, when the worship of the living God is made central, it has fired people with moral earnestness, inflamed their ethical zeal, and sent them forth to right wrongs in society. Like nothing else, worship makes us aware that we belong to a universal spiritual kingdom. Perhaps the one great temptation that confronts us is the temptation to live in a kind of religious ghetto, bound in by pride of orthodoxy, and I have utmost respect. I do not intend to speak otherwise, but sometimes bound in by a determination to maintain the status quo, offensive denominational pride, race prejudice, professional fear, true worship calls on us to be world citizens and properly energizes us for redemptive living in all areas of life. And may I say in conclusion that if our traditional practices are to have vital meaning, if our programming is to be more than activism, if our efforts in evangelism are to realize fruition, and if we are to have a voice as God's stewards of grace, there must be genuine worship of God. Shall we bow for the benediction? Our Holy Father, in this hour of need, we are grateful that we can turn to Thee in faith. We're grateful for all of the evidences that undergird our faith, that give encouragement. And now as we go our various ways to meet our diverse responsibilities, our prayer is that we might be continually aware of Thy presence, energizing, vitalizing, and guiding. For we pray in the name of Christ, our Master.